It's time for a more in-depth look at today's news. It's time to find out who's pulling the strings. It's time for the Behind the Curtain podcast with your host, author Jeff Reynolds.
Hi, I'm author Jeff Reynolds, and this is episode 23 of the Behind the Curtain podcast. Before we begin, I want to remind you to check out my new website, jeffreyreynolds.net. That's www.jeffreyreynolds.net. This is where you'll find all of my content from all the different platforms where my articles can be read. Also, I want to ask you a favor. When you go to jeffreyreynolds.net, please sign up for my newsletter. I won't spam you, and I'll send out a couple of emails a month tops. This allows me to keep you updated on all the cool stuff I'm doing in 2020. I made it really easy, too. Just go to the website and click on the link that says subscribe to the newsletter. My first interview this week is with Brianna Sagdahl, who's running against Ken Humberston for Clackamas County Commission. Bria has been a tireless advocate and activist in Oregon for several years. She's been on the front lines of the Timber Unity Movement, the Medical Freedom Movement, the defense of the Second Amendment, and the fight against such onerous fiscal policies as cap and trade. She's advocated for parental rights and against an ever-increasing intrusion by government into family matters. She's running to bring sanity and ethics back to Clackamas County Commission. We talked about the reasons she's running and the importance of her race for all of Oregon. You can find more information at www.votesagdahl.com, and that's S-A-G-D-A-L. The second interview this week is with, well, me. So many things have changed in our world since the last episode of Behind the Curtain. I wanted to take this segment to take stock and talk about everything that's happened since the world ground to a halt in March when the Chinese Communist Party wreaked havoc on the world with its virus. I'll discuss the virus itself, the massive economic lockdown that promises to cause at least as much damage as the virus itself, and how we can find our way out of this mess. I'll also talk about the inevitability of an economic depression and what you should be doing right now to prepare. Don't forget to subscribe to the Behind the Curtain podcast wherever you listen to it, and please leave a positive rating. The more subscribers and the better ratings, the higher the Behind the Curtain podcast will rank on podcast services like Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts, among many others. Stick around to the very end so you can hear a full version of I Am America, the theme song, by my buddy Brian Futch. Hey, did you know I wrote a book? It's called Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. And let me tell you, it couldn't be more timely than it is now with everything that's going on in the political world. It's an examination of the dark money on the left that continues to fuel the worst of the swamp creatures in Washington, D.C. There's a real appetite out there for folks to learn about who's pulling the strings on the left and what their ultimate goals are. I've done several speaking engagements over the last handful of months, and I'm looking for more. If you know any conservative clubs, Republican groups, Tea Party or 912 clubs, or anyone else who could get something out of following the dark money on the left, please email me at jeff@jeffreyreynolds.net. Search for Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy in stores or online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Simon & Schuster. It's available in hardback, Kindle, or Nook now. Check out whoownsthedems.com for more information. All right, welcome back into the Behind the Curtain podcast. My name is Jeff Reynolds. I'm your host, and I'm here with a good friend of mine I've worked with quite a bit over the last year or so here in Oregon. Her name is Brianna Sagdahl. She's running for Clackamas County Commissioner, and I want to welcome Brianna in and talk about her campaign, the issues that are important to Clackamas County, and a whole bunch of other stuff that might have been happening over the last week or two. So, Brianna, welcome into the show.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jeff. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit of background. I know you were involved in grassroots politics for a little bit before you decided to run for office. So kind of break that down for me. What were you involved in? And then what made you decide to run for office?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So I've had a lot of government experience in the last several years. The grassroots efforts happened sort of as a byproduct of making urgent calls to action. So I started out going through policy and analyzing policy as a citizen lobbyist. And I got started in the war room, room 350 in the Capitol. And there were several issues that brought me into the war room, but the war room really helped shape me and helped me, you know, really be able to break down policy on a tangible level where I could put out calls to the grassroots and say, you know, attention, attention, this is what's happening. This is how it's going to affect you. And I love the Oregon Citizens Lobby because each piece of policy is analyzed through five lenses, you know, so there's local controls, fiscal responsibility, that sort of thing. And so from there, it really progressed into this ramping up of the grassroots efforts. And it was this beautiful organic thing that happened over a period of time. And I think really just all of Oregon realizing collectively within the same time frame that what was at stake here was, you know, priceless. And it's all of our lives, our children, our future, our homes, our businesses. And the way that the policy has been written for the last few years has been ramping up and giving so much power to unelected agencies and bureaucrats, where we, the people who are paying for these services, have absolutely no control and no oversight as to where the money's going, how it's being spent, and really where the power is going. So there's been this gradual shift away from a representative republic into, you know, these bureaucratic agencies that, again, have absolutely no public oversight. And so, like I said, it's been this gradual awakening that has happened. And, you know, I was just the person who happened to be in the right place at the right time, doing a lot of work. So, you know, I can't take credit for everything that's happened. Just one person, amongst a lot of really amazing people who have been a part of everything that's been going on.
Yeah, no, that's great. And that's, I think that's really how those kinds of things get started, right? Is you never realize how important it is to get involved until you start getting involved. And then you look around and see so many things that are going in ways that we never intended them to go. And so you just have to kind of dig your heels in and start working. So you did a lot of work in the legislature over the last year or so, trying to work on bills and work on several issues all at once, Second Amendment issues and medical freedom issues and beginnings of the timber unity movement and all of that stuff. So what were the things that happened over the last year or so, the last two legislative sessions, that really motivated you?
So thanks. So I started getting involved in politics on more of a policy level, looking at DHS issues and CPS issues around the country, actually. And what brought me to our Capitol was a myriad of issues between medical freedom and DHS issues. But most importantly, last year we had 3063, which was a bill that would have removed philosophical and religious exemptions for vaccines for children in order to attend public school. And for me, that was really just completely unacceptable because, you know, we have children who have had horrible reactions to vaccines, who would not have been able to get or qualify for medical exemption under the bill, the way that it was written. And so it was in strict adherence to the ACIP guidelines, which have very, very small variation for really just common sense reasons why somebody wouldn't be able to vaccinate or receive a vaccine. And so there was this, you know, equity side of it also, where it would have kicked 36,000 kids out of public school, a lot of them dependent on school in order, you know, to get school lunches and other vital services. So there was a lot of reasons why that bill didn't sit right with me. And so I started getting involved with the Oregon Citizens Lobby, like I said, in that legislative session when we first knew that this bill was going to be taking shape. And it was an amazing process where inroads were created. And I would like to think that through the efforts of all the moms and also the Russian Old Believer community who got involved that legislative session, set the groundwork for some of the most amazing things that we have seen come out of Salem in the last year or so, you know, with timber unity and the grassroots efforts. But I think that those early days are really what paved the way for what we think of now as the grassroots effort and the various inroads that were created between all the different groups. And, you know, when we broke it down and started explaining it to the 2A group and the Patriots, we started breaking it down and explaining it to farmers and agriculture or anybody who loves freedom, right? We broke it down on just a very simplistic liberty level that this is an infringement upon bodily autonomy, informed consent, and personal choice of the individual for the sake of, you know, the collective, this idea. People really started resonating with that and understanding what we were talking about and getting on board. You know, there was this stigma that we were sort of crunchy, hippie, essential oil wearing moms who just didn't want to give our children antibiotics, right? And we would rather maybe pray over them than give them, you know, vital medication to save their lives. And so we had to break through a lot of barriers. And I think, you know, we're seeing a lot of that in many of the narratives that are being pushed today, like either, you know, maybe climate change or even today with COVID, right? So we're having to break through preconceived notions in order to get down to the data, the statistics, and the facts so that people can actually make an informed decision for themselves. And what I have seen personally is when people are handed all the information, they tend to side with those of us who have been fighting. That's just what I personally see. There are sometimes people go the other way, having all the information. But I would say that's the rare case and not the norm.
Yeah, yeah. So let's transition now to your decision to run for office. This, I believe, is the first time you've ever run for any sort of public office. How did that come to be? And then talk about the issues that are important to Clackamas County. We've got a whole bunch of stuff going on right now, obviously, and it's all based on what decisions are being made in Salem. So talk about why you decided to run for that particular office and the issues that you're running to help fix.
Goodness. Yes, absolutely. So the number one reason why I decided to run is because I feel like I can do a better job than those who are there, you know.
Well, there you go.
I mean, I'm just looking around at the utter incompetence and ineptitude of individuals who are currently in office. And whew, boy, I would hope that individuals would rise to the challenge. You know, in running, I'm understanding now why so few choose this road as a means of affecting change. It is not fun. It is not easy. It's, you know,
it's a real wake up call, isn't it?
it absolutely is. And, you know, in the grassroots, they are so quick to point out, you know, the issues, but very seldom do they rise to the challenge and put $100 in the kitty for a candidate of their choice to make sure they get elected. And so what you're left with is sort of the Salem slew, as we like to call it, the typical players who end up in office time and time again because they have the same funding mechanisms and the same special interest, backdoor handshake deals that have been going on for the last, you know, however many decades. And those are the people who end up getting the financing and being in office. So anyways, long story short, I looked around and I said, boy, we need better options. So I decided to be a martyr and offer myself up.
There you go. Yeah. No, I've done it before and you have no idea what you're getting into until you start jumping into it. It's really quite a process to be a candidate.
It really is. And I honestly, it's been a humbling experience. And regardless of where people stand on the issues, I appreciate the fact that they have gone through this before me, and I have a newfound level of appreciation and respect, I'll have to say.
There you go. Okay, so let's talk specifically Clackamas County Commission. What are the issues you're running on? What are the issues that the incumbent has failed to address? And just talk about what's important to the voters of Clackamas County.
Absolutely. And so, you know, in terms of issues, I really, I think it's important to think about our actions and where those will get us, you know. And so I want to improve everybody's quality of life. And so what that means is I want to ensure that we take a really good look at our budget. I think we need a forensic audit of not only our budget, but all of our agencies. And so this isn't a way of like pointing the finger and saying, you know, this person hasn't done enough or these people are just crooked and corrupt. I think anytime a company gets taken over, for example, right, what's the first thing they do? They go in, they take a look and a forensic look at the budget. You have to know where you're at in order to understand what cuts, if any, are feasible, and make sure that they're made in a responsible and an appropriate manner where you're not reducing essential and vital services, especially during a housing opioid and, you know, pandemic, right? That's going to be absolutely vital to know where we can make cuts if appropriate, or, you know, if we do need additional taxes, why, right? I think the voters deserve an answer, and they deserve very clear guidance as to where their money is being spent and why they need to put more back into this government. I think that's very fair. And so another part of improving people's quality of life would be working intergovernmentally and making sure that our commissioners are standing up to the onslaught that's coming from Salem. I've seen so many times where our commissioners just go along to get along. And quite frankly, that's unacceptable to me, because on the county level, we have so much more power than is being exerted right now. And so I think that our county commissioners have a responsibility to the individuals and also each municipality that's in that county to stand up to Salem right now and say, you know, we're not going to enact that. If you pass that piece of legislation, we're not going to do that here on our county.
And so do you have specific examples of legislation that you've looked at that the county should have taken a stronger stance on? I know we've talked a lot about like transportation issues and tolling, and you know, Clackamas County really is the epicenter of the tolling debate, because you've got I-5 and I-205 that go right through the heart of Clackamas County. So
right.
That's an issue, obviously. But what are some of the issues where the Clackamas County Commission needs to take a stronger stand against what the legislature is doing to them?
Thank you. I have many, many examples, but I'll just go with the most recent example, which is 1530. That was this legislative session answer to last year's 2020, or cap and trade, if you will. I believe at the end of the total, we had 28 separate counties stand up against cap and trade. Clackamas County was one of, I think, only three counties that wouldn't stand up and oppose it. And I think those 28 other counties sent a very clear message to the legislature, giving our Republican senators and House representatives the support they needed to walk out and close the door on any conversation about quorum, for example. Like, we had many conversations in Salem about amending the bill and addressing cap and trade where it was failing the voters and where rural Oregon was very upset. And each one of those amendments were voted down. So it really fell to the county commissions to stand up for their constituents. And we just didn't see that. Another example would be Metro. So we have the T-2020 measure that's been, you know, we've gone round and round and round. And I really don't feel that our county commissioners are standing up for us on this one either, particularly in rural Clackamas. And then we had a housing measure that was
passed. And forgive me, what is that Metro measure that you're referring to?
Sorry, thank you. So the T-2020 is the transportation getting us there. I think it's getting us there together measure. And so essentially what is being asked is rural Clackamas County fork out more money to pay for light rail, to pay for mass transit, to pay for more buses to run. And we will never see that. we will never see the benefit of that in our small rural towns. In Clackamas County, the average home has 2 cars and commutes 26 minutes to work. What I would like to see instead is more than the 20% of our entire transportation budget going back into our critical infrastructure and our roads. You know, if you want to mitigate climate change or carbon emissions, widen our roads. We know that one of the top things that that adds pollution and carbon emissions into our atmospheres, idling vehicles. And we have way too many idling vehicles through the bottleneck of I-205 and then also through the Rose Corridor project. And so those really need to be our focus, not to mention the fact that in the event of a Cascadia subduction event, the I-205 Abernathy Bridge would cut us off from essential medical, fuel, food, you name it. It would completely cut us off. We would be in really bad shape.
And that's a problem that you're seeing in Portland too, right? Is while Portland is going on a road diet and they're reducing lanes of travel, that completely screws up everything for an emergency response, even in a normal emergency, never mind some sort of a natural disaster.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, and I think it's funny with COVID-19, you know, all of these issues that we have brought up as what if this happens when it comes to policy.
And we're seeing it right now, right? Exactly. I mean, this is what if.
That is exactly right. And so we have raised the red flag time and time again in the past 30 years, and we get brushed aside and we're told, oh, that'll never happen. And it has left us completely ill-prepared for when it does happen. And I think that's, you know, a critical difference between the way that people look at things. And I think it's our responsibility as government entities and officials to look at every possibility that might happen so that we can mitigate it ahead of time. And I think that we really dropped the ball on that. And so I would like to make sure we're not continuously dropping the ball. You know, the same thing and the road diet, as you put it, which is fantastic, happened in Paradise, California, right before their wildfires. And
that's right.
Unfortunately, they went from 4-lane highways down to 2-lane highways, and people literally burned in their cars. I mean, it's horrible. It's absolutely horrific. And I don't want to see that happen to the people here in my county that I love and I care about.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And I think that you're seeing this play out. There was just an article today in the Oregonian about how we've got all the testing capability and it's all being stashed and not used and only used on medical personnel. So one of the conditions that Governor Brown has put on reopening Oregon for business has been widespread testing capability, and we apparently have it and we're not using it, which is just the height of incompetence in our public officials.
Boy, I have about a million things I'd like to say to that. You know, I think it's time. I think it's time that the public sector bypasses the government in things such as testing. I know that there's a.
I mean, that's something you could do on the county level, right? Is you could actually have that capability. You could use your budget to purchase those kits and be able to bypass everything that's being stalled in Salem.
That's 100% correct, Jeff. And there's a company right now that is being used in Germany, being used in South Korea, and it's an at-home testing kit. It's the company is Biomedonics, and it has the test results for you in the comfort of your own home within 15 minutes. And can you imagine how that would reduce the exposure rate to frontline medical staff if individuals knew their own immunity rate? So whether they have already been exposed and they have antibodies and they're immune, or if they are currently sick and they have COVID-19, either way, you're being able to make an informed decision. And for me, I believe that true leadership gives every individual the full potential of full disclosure and informed decision and informed consent. So we're only as strong as our weakest link. And, you know, this whole conversation about the collective it's frustrating because the collective is only as strong as each individual that's bearing the weight of the collective.
Yeah, no, that's true. And so I think that really we have gotten so far down the hole of kind of trusting the state government to tell us what we want to hear, but say, well, we don't want to really do anything on our own without listening to the experts first. But there's you look at what's happening in Salem, and there's so much incompetence going on, and there's such a lack of leadership going on out of Kate Brown that we don't have the ability as individuals to make that informed decision because they're falling down on their job. So it comes down to everybody else saying, you know, I have to do what I have to do to make my family survive. You know, right. We've got to make these decisions without government. And if we could rely on government to do something competently, that would be a real nice change.
Absolutely. You know, and even something small that our county commissioners could be doing right now is working with the major area CCOs, working with the Oregon Health Authority, and, you know, having conversations with our insurance companies to make these at-home test kits affordable for your average family. So we could come up with something like a $10 copay. And if, you know, absolutely necessary, the county could subsidize, you know, some of the copays for lower income families. But I think that's one thing that we could do right now to safely get people back to work and start utilizing the phase program and the guidance that just came out from the White House. I have, you know, a really good friend, Jonathan Lockwood, who just created a coalition called Reopen America. And they're setting up guidance and a coalition of legislators from each state to help guide us back to opening America. I mean, this really needs to be our focus. And
absolutely. Yeah. There was just an article in the Oregon Catalyst showing that up to 20% of small businesses in Oregon have already closed.
Right. Absolutely. And small businesses are bread and butter. It's the backbone of America. So we need to focus on getting small business back up and running and getting our economy restarted. You know, there was one thing that I actually just posted about this on my Facebook page. And for anybody who doesn't follow me, please go onto Facebook, look me up, Brianna Sagdahl, send me a friend request or send me a message and follow me on Facebook because I'm constantly posting on there lots of great content. And you can, you know, stay up to date on my campaign and all the information that I've got out, ways to get involved, ways to volunteer, ways to donate, that sort of thing. Anyways, so I had just posted, you know, one idea that would make Oregon a leader in the global economy. And all we would have to do is to reopen our forestry area. I mean, we have given way too much power over to the federal government where they are supposedly stewards of our forestry, and they're not doing anything. So we have a veritable tinderbox of overplanted trees that are all, you know, very tightly stuck together or knocked over. And I mean, it is honestly, it's a matchbox. If you go up the Molalla Corridor where I live, for example, we have browned and down trees all up and down that corridor, and we're expected to have, you know, it's a forecasted record wildfire year. So it honestly doesn't make any sense to me to let our forests burn when we have men and women who can get in there and harvest these timber crops that have been planted 20 years ago. It's honestly, it's time to harvest them. And it's time to use that money and put it back into our transportation and to our schools, quite frankly, is where it was supposed to go in the first place. And it's something we could do right now. If you've ever been out in the woods, you know for a fact that social distancing is not a problem. And I mean, there's billions of board feet that if we don't harvest it are going to burn. So
yeah, and that's a really big issue for Clackamas County, because Clackamas County goes all the way to Mount Hood, and you've got national forests, you've got state forests, you've got private land out there, all of it. And it's a, you know, once you get out of McLaughlin Boulevard or the rural or the urban areas of Clackamas County, it's very rural, and it's such a dynamic and diverse county that you've got almost everything you got to deal with.
That's right. And on top of that, you know, we've got record revenues because we have record amount of people moving to Clackamas County. And in all honesty, we need to open up particular areas for building and development. I mean, it's something like, I think we have 48,000 affordable homes, or a deficit of affordable housing right now. We have we have a deficit of 22,000 units for housing, just period. And so I think that really we need to be working with our developers and not just shutting them out or overtaxing them. I mean, from what I understand, it's something like $140,000 just to break ground. I mean, literally just to put a shovel in the ground and start a build, you're looking at $140,000 before you can even start the work. That is not really a very big incentive for developers to want to build. And, you know, so I honestly, I feel like we need to be working very closely with our planning commissions in each local municipality, because they're going to know their area best. They're going to know the individuals who live there and the character of their own backyards. And, we need to focus on those local controls and work with developers, incentivize developers. You know, there are certain parts of our county where mixed zoning would be perfect. So we could do something like, you know, waive permitting fees for developers, give them the opportunity to build, allow them to sell out the lower portion to like Zupan's, Trader Joe's, you know, Safeway, whatever, you get the idea. And then as long as they provide a certain amount of units on the top half for low income or tax credit or Section 8 housing, then they, you know, have reduced property tax. And then we take that tax, we put it in an infrastructure kitty so that we can put it back towards schools and roads that are going to need to be widened and new schools that will need to be built in the area for those, you know, new units that are coming in. But to allow people to continue to live under underpasses because we can't come to agreements or make informed and common sense decisions on where, how, and when to build, quite frankly, is unacceptable. And then the solutions that have come out of our commission to enter into this massive collaborative agreement with Metro, where they're going to end up using our money to build in their county, that doesn't make sense either. So really, I think we need that humility that allows people to come back to the drawing board and say, all right, we understand there's a problem. We recognize the issue. And we're going to come back to the drawing board and we're going to start again. We're going to keep it local. We're going to discuss this with the individuals and the stakeholders who are going to be the most impacted here. And then we're going to start this again where we're not bankrupting our businesses in the county, because quite frankly, all we're seeing right now are businesses boarding up and our most prosperous companies laying people off, closing their doors and leaving our county and leaving our state altogether for that matter. Because again, back to that whole idea of the collective only being as strong as the individual, when you continue to wipe out individual after individual, that collective weakens. And if you think of it like a beam support structure, as you knock out each beam, the structure is going to fall. I mean, that's all there is to it.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Okay, so Brianna Sagdahl, we, believe it or not, have gotten to the end of our half-hour segment already. It has flown by, and you've done a great job of addressing the issue. So thank you for coming on the show. I want to give you one more opportunity to give a shout for your website, your social media links, wherever people can go to learn more about your campaign for Clackamas County Commission.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Yeah, absolutely. You can check me out at www.vote.com. Sagdal. That's SAGDAL.com. There is a handy dandy donate link down at the bottom. I've not been actively fundraising because of the crisis, but you know, if you have a little bit of extra money, you believe in what I'm saying, you know, put $20 in there, buy me a coffee, you know, and get signed up. Come help us put up signs. If you have a field and you can put a sign in your backyard, give me a call. I'm very easily found online. My phone number, my email address, find me on Facebook. Like I said, Brianna Sagdal, or you can find Vote Brianna Sagdal for County Clackamas County Commissioner. Thank you
Perfect.
So much.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate you coming on and talking about the issues. I wish we had two more hours because there's a lot of issues to deal with.
Right.
Yeah, so maybe we'll have you back on again in the future and talk even more in depth about that stuff. So well, thanks again for coming on.
I'd love to address public safety the next time.
Yep, public safety, homelessness, infrastructure, transportation, medical responses, all of that stuff at the county level is all very important. So we'll have you back on. We'll really get into it at that point. But thanks again, Fantastic. Brianna. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, Jeff.
If you like this podcast, the best way you can support it is by leaving a rating and subscribing. And don't forget to buy my book, Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. Now it's on to my second segment, in which I provide commentary on current events. Welcome back to the Behind the Curtain podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Reynolds, and I'm going to take a little bit of a different tack with this segment today. I wanted to talk a little bit about just everything that's gone on. It's been quite some time since I put out a podcast episode. I think it was February, and it's now May, and things have gone a little bit differently than normal since then. We knew about coronavirus back in February, but we weren't really taking it all that seriously. And since then, governors across the nation and the Trump administration have recommended and in some cases ordered shutdowns of economic activity, of personal travel, of personal liberties, and ordered people to wear masks in some cases. Some municipalities have gone further than state level orders, like Governor Newsom in California or Governor Brown here in Oregon. But the bottom line is that so many things have been shut down that we are in unprecedented economic times. I've written quite extensively about this at PJ Media, and I've written a lot about the pushback that we're getting from a lot of ordinary folks who have seen their financial lives completely ruined. And a lot of folks, there's been so much debate, and it falls on political lines, and it's really disappointing to watch. We've seen so many people shame folks for even bringing up the economic devastation that we're causing with these shutdowns. We've seen so many people on the other side saying that, well, this is just a hoax, and there's nothing to this virus, and it's just the flu. And I'm here in the middle kind of saying, okay, well, I believe both things. The virus is a very serious issue, and it's having a massive impact on public health. So we need to deal with it seriously. However, we can do it in a way, and I've been advocating this for a while, that doesn't intrude upon personal liberty and constitutionally protected individual liberty. And that's really the breakdown here. And if you even bring this stuff up, that's what's so disappointing to me, is that if you even bring this stuff up with some folks who are so invested in their argument being right, that they shame you. They say that you want to kill people, or that you care more about the dollar and the profit than you do about the virus and killing grandma at the nursing home. And, you know, I don't understand where the panic comes from on this, but nothing obviously could be further from the truth, that you can be concerned about the effects of the virus, and you can also be concerned about the economy, which is going to plunge into a depression, and it's inevitable at this point. And you can also be concerned about the massive overreach of government in granting itself power that it never should have had, and whether or not they will ever give those powers up. Being concerned about government giving up their powers is a uniquely American thing to do, and it's something that all Americans, even if you're panicked, if you're terrified about this virus, you should be at least as equally panicked about what government is doing and what government is giving itself the power to do on a permanent basis. Once government grabs power like that, it rarely lets go without a fight. And so that's where I'm at with all of this. I'm concerned about the virus, although I'm also concerned about the arbitrary nature of the social distancing rules and whether or not we should be wearing masks and gloves. And if I'm supposed to wear a mask going to Costco, why aren't all of the employees at that Costco wearing the mask properly to prevent the spread of disease? Because, oh, by the way, you still have to put it over your nose to make it effective. So this whole idea that we're stopping the spread of the disease sure looks like, on the surface, to be more feel-good demonstrations of we're doing something than actually doing something effective. So I've got grave concerns about what we're doing as a society and what the world is doing to respond to this virus and what we're doing to our economy. It is absolutely unprecedented what we've done. I've written a lot about this at PJ Media and gotten pushback for that too, where I want people to know definitively how bad things are getting with the economy. I want people to see the numbers that are being put out there. We now have lost 33.5 million jobs in the last 7 weeks. And every time I put an article out at PJ about what's going on with the economy, I get people pushing back saying, well, why are you focused so much on the bad news? And why aren't you put a happy face on? And why aren't you telling good news? If you don't realize how bad this news is, then you're going to be completely unprepared for the economic fallout that's about to happen. There's been an article going around this week that states that there will be somewhere in the neighborhood of 75,000 deaths due to the economic fallout from all of these job losses and all this lack of economic activity in the inability to go to work and the inability to provide for your family. We're talking about such mental health issues as just a gamut of mental health effects that lead to such things as elevated risks of suicide, elevated risks of addiction, all of those things. And that's why I'm trying to bang the drum, because it seems like so many folks are so focused on the virus and the assumption that our economy is just going to get back to normal as soon as we lift the restrictions. People aren't looking at the long term. People aren't realizing how bad this is going to be. And make no mistake, it's going to be bad. Today is May 10th, and several administration officials went on the Sunday news shows. It's actually Mother's Day, and these administrative officials went all over the Sunday news shows to talk about how bad the economy is going to get. We're looking at 25% unemployment by the time May is over, because we're not stopping the job losses right now. And that's what's really irresponsible about all of these orders from these various governors, Inslee and Brown and Newsom and Pritzker and the guy in Ohio and Cuomo and all these governors that have had such heavy-handed reactions to the virus that it's completely irresponsible. They should have taken a much more balanced approach to dealing with this virus. They didn't have to be so heavy-handed to stop the spread of the virus. You give them an inch, they take a mile. They've gone so far that and have completely ignored and shirked their responsibility. They have not lived up to their responsibility to ensure that the response to the virus is not worse than the virus. But that's exactly what's happened. And again, I have to reiterate, because I'm going to get accused, because it's already happened, I am not minimizing the effects of the virus. The virus is a very serious problem, and we needed an all-of-government reaction to deal with the spread of the virus, to minimize fatalities, to minimize the effect on the human population. But again, you could easily have had a reaction that was even-handed, rational, reasonable, and didn't destroy our economy. But you know what? At this point, there's no turning back. We could flip the switch tomorrow to open everything back up again, and the effects on our economy will still last years. But we're not even talking about turning on the economy because we've got so many states that are saying, well, these activities are banned until September. I think in Oregon, we're talking about September for any large sporting events or gatherings or concerts. The state fair was canceled, you know. So there are months and months of residual effects still to be felt on the economy, which will only hamper the rebuild process that we need to go through. And make no mistake, we need to go through it. And that's the biggest thing that concerns me. Is you've got so many people, former President Obama and Andrew Cuomo and Jay Inslee and Kate Brown and Gavin Newsom all coming out and saying things like this is an opportunity to fundamentally change our society. And what they mean by that is they mean communism, they mean socialism, they mean changing our economy to be not a free market economy. And this is what we need to guard against. They want to ban large gatherings altogether. Here in Portland, we closed 100 miles of city streets to encourage social distancing. So no cars can drive on these streets. Why would we do something like that? Is that actually going to lead to more social distancing? Or is that an opportunity to use the virus to fundamentally change people's behaviors with the force of law, the force of government behind it? That's what's going on, folks. We are losing liberties. We are changing behaviors with the force of government. And we have a bunch of tin pot dictators doing these things that don't give a damn about this virus. They don't care about personal liberty. In fact, they think personal liberty is inconvenient and the Constitution gets in the way. They're not interested whatsoever in social distancing or creating a world where this virus isn't under control. That's not their focus. That's not their goal. That's just a means to an end. But you're seeing a lot of pushback now. I think a lot of folks are realizing this, that there's so much going on that is not right, that is not proper for government, that is not constitutional, given the constitutional limits on government. And let's all remember, that's what the U.S. Constitution is all about. It's not about limiting personal liberty. It's limiting the power of government and preserving personal liberty. And a lot of folks are pushing back, realizing that the reaction has been all wrong. I wrote about this last week. The salon owner, Lindsey Graham, ironically named, of course, but Lindsey Graham, the salon owner in Salem, who reopened her salon because she had to. She's under financial strain like a lot of us. I happen to be blessed in a financially secure situation, but I'm an ever decreasing minority, I think. So many folks are in such bad shape that they have to return to work. And that's really it. That's the crux of the issue, is the dignity of meaningful work. That's what's been removed for too many people. And that's what people like Lindsey Graham are responding to. So she opened up her salon and had protesters outside supporting her. I wrote about this at PJ Media, and that was only a couple of days after last weekend's rally at the Capitol that drew 2,000 people in a driving rainstorm to protest against Kate Brown's illegal, unconstitutional economic shutdown. Again, I have to reiterate the point that these are normal folks who are fed up with being told that they cannot return to their normal, productive work life for no good reason. And I have to reiterate that this is something that could absolutely have been avoided, but the combination of incompetence and not understanding what's effective and what's not, along with the innate tendency of people in power to exercise that power. I mean, all you got to do is look at the difference between Inslee and Brown and Kemp of Georgia and DeSantis of Florida. Those guys reopened early and have not seen a spike in the virus spread. So Florida did not destroy its economy. Georgia partially destroyed its economy, but got back to work as quickly as it could. Texas is in the middle of reopening their state. And by the way, reopening their churches as well, and not trampling on the First Amendment rights guaranteed in the Constitution. There's nothing in the Constitution that says, well, we can suspend this if there's a really scary virus out there. I have to go back once again. I often return to this refrain that if these were such good ideas, like stopping a pandemic, why do all these things have to be mandatory? If it's such a good idea, wouldn't everybody just voluntarily say, oh, yeah, we should probably stop this pandemic? We can govern ourselves. And that's what the Constitution is all about, is self-governance. America is the greatest experiment in the history of mankind, the experiment in self-governance. So what are we going to choose? Anyway, I wanted to just talk a few minutes about that and talk about a few of the things that I've been writing about at PJ Media. All of the things that we're looking at in this world, it's time to stop preventing people from productive activity. Preventing people from productive activity will have much greater effect on society than the virus. The virus needs to be dealt with. The virus is dangerous. The virus is a pandemic. And oh, by the way, it was caused by the Communist Party of China and their communist government. Those people are hand in hand with the World Health Organization. The CCP engaged in an extensive campaign of lying and propaganda. And oh, by the way, as we learned in the webinar by the Oregon Republican Party just this past Thursday with Steve Yates, they deliberately shut down all internal travel as soon as they found out how serious the virus was, but they also allowed 5,000 Chinese nationals to travel to America. Now, you tell me whether that was deliberate or not, and you tell me whether the Chinese Communist Party is culpable for this pandemic. We already know that they, with their Belt and Road campaign, they were heavily involved in Italy, and the outbreak in Italy that killed so many people was directly related to how many Chinese nationals were in the country at the time. China has blood on its hands, literally, the Chinese Communist Party, I should say, and they're going to need to be made to pay. But we are also fighting back here in Oregon. We have another webinar coming up this Thursday on the legal culpability of Kate Brown and her legal vulnerability in all of these orders. Kevin Mannix is going to do a webinar for the Oregon Republican Party this Thursday at 7 p.m. Go to oregon.gop/insidescoop to sign up. This is going to be a great event, and I'm looking forward to many more of these going forward. There will be lawsuits, there will be court cases, there will be takings cases where the government forced businesses to shut down and owe compensation to those businesses. This will go on for years. The legal fight over these shutdowns is going to go on maybe a decade. But also, what's going to go on for maybe a decade, as we saw from the Great Recession and from the Great Depression, is this economic shutdown. The economic shutdown may end sometime this year. I certainly hope so. I mean, goodness, if it went on beyond this year, then the catastrophe would be unimaginable. But we're already seeing structural problems because of the shutdowns. I've written about this, the toilet paper shortages, the raw milk being dumped at dairies all across the nation, the shutdowns at the meat plants because of viral outbreaks, the complete disruption of the supply chain in our ever more interconnected economy, where we've got plenty of produce, but we can't get it to market because there's a difference between the commercial supply chains that have been shut down because there's no college going on. There's no dorms being and dining halls being supplied. Restaurants are completely closed. So the commercial supply chains have been completely disrupted. And it's not just like switching it to a different track and moving all of that stuff to the retail market where there's much higher demand now, both because there's panic buying and because there's more people staying at home and not going to restaurants. So the retail supply chains have been stressed beyond belief. On top of that, we have such little demand for gas and petroleum products that the price of oil has imploded. What that means is more bankruptcies will be coming in the energy sector. That means that supply chains in the energy sector will be disrupted. This is not just going to fix itself if we decide to flip the switch back on again. There are structural damages that have been caused that are not going to fix themselves overnight. So we are headed into an extended, prolonged depression. I've seen estimates that we will not emerge from this economic catastrophe for a decade. I've seen estimates of, from the administration, of a 40% contraction in our economy. That means a lot of people are going to be out of work for a very long time, and you need to be prepared for it. Strongly suggest that you get out of debt, you make yourself liquid, you stock up on supplies, and you prepare yourself for the coming storm. There will be times when the shelves at the grocery stores will be completely empty. You need to prepare now while supplies are still available. This is easily doable, and it's not, I don't want to put a complete doom and gloom mood on this, but for those who have not always prepared for future catastrophes, now is a great time to start learning to be prepared. Have extra supplies on hand and be ready for shortages, because they're coming. This economic depression is going to be unlike anything we've ever seen. It already has been unlike anything we've ever seen because we deliberately shut down our economy. We've never done that before. And I can only imagine how it's going to turn out. So anyway, that's my musings on what's going on right now and how we need to stay connected, stay involved, stay together, stay prepared, and weather the storm. Everybody has the power individually to put themselves in the best position possible. And I'd encourage you as an individual and if you have family members or people in your close circle that are in need to take care of each other. All right. Thank you once again for listening to the Behind the Curtain podcast. I'm Jeff Reynolds, your host, and we'll be back at this again next week.
Thanks for checking out the Behind the Curtain podcast. I want to thank my buddy Brian Futch for providing me the theme song, I Am America, produced by Cass Anawati. Join us next week for another episode of Behind the Curtain with Jeff Reynolds.
Great Grandpa sailed here from across the ocean. Nothing else but his dream for a better life. His folks over there shook their heads at such a crazy notion. But deep down in his heart, he knew he was right. He cleared the way for you and me. You can still hear his spirit sings, I am America. This land is my land, America. I know one day after I'm gone, someone will carry this dream along, and that's what makes this country so strong. There's no price for his country he wouldn't pay. Like so many others, he fought for the cause with great devotion. Just like his daddy, he led the way. Yeah, yeah, yeah. His stories have faded with his years, but his eyes say it loud. After